This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Melody Moisey has always been outspoken. As an Iranian-American writer and attorney, she's devoted herself to discussing controversial issues like religion, politics, and culture in Iran. But when she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, her family and doctors encouraged silence. On this issue, they thought, you could not speak the truth. Melody would not be quiet. She decided to write a memoir about her experiences so that others with the disorder and those who know them can better understand. The memoir is called Haldol and Hyacinth, A Bipolar Life. She's going to be at Quail Ridge Books on August 7th, but joins us now in the studio. Melody, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your background. Born to Iranian parents, but living in this country. In fact, you write in your book, being an Iranian and American is like being a child of divorced parents. What do you mean?
You know, I was born the year of the revolution, 1979. So there's never been a point in my life where these two countries have been friends. And not only enemies, but the worst of enemies. If you were to ask most Americans, what's the country that we hate the most? They would say America or Iran and vice versa. Although I would say Iranians wouldn't say that as much. I think it's a political issue. I'm not saying that people hate each other. But yeah, that's something I've lived with my whole life. And it's also something I've never thought to hide at all, unlike my mental illness, which was something that I was immediately told to be quiet about. And as an activist, I had worked a lot by the time I was diagnosed, defending the human rights of the LGBT community, Muslims, Iranians, Muslims after 9/11. And, you know, as a Muslim after 9/11, I thought, you know, nothing could be worse than this. There couldn't be a form of discrimination this bad in terms of what I could experience. But I was wrong.
Well, I would like you to talk a little bit more about that experience. Again, the feeling. I mean, so you've painted a picture and said here, after the Iranian Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini comes into power, Iran becomes public enemy number one in the United States. So we get that picture from our point of view. But for you, growing up, I mean, did you feel it? Did people say things to you? How did you internalize that tension that the rest of us, not having that background, might not have felt?
Well, I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, and I will give credit to the people there in general. Ohioans are pretty smart. Americans in general, I found, are pretty smart. It's a matter of just not knowing. Once they're educated, they're willing to let go of hatred and bigotry if they had it before. So that is not something I experienced a lot of during the Iran-Iraq War, or rather during the Iraq War. I was in middle school. And at that time, it was everyone, you know, confuses Iraq and Iran. So some people
and
told me to go back to my country. And I was like, first of all, America is my country. Secondly, it's not Iraq. It's
right.
So
then you take up the causes of other people who are feeling the brunt of this. I mean, do you think that your experiences growing up had anything to do with your calling and your decision in your profession?
For sure. I've been an activist my whole life. As early as 7 years old, I staged a neighborhood protest to get the ice cream man to come to our neighborhood. And I'm very proud to say that he still comes to Wooden Shoe Lane. That was one of my most successful endeavors as an activist.
Way to go.
It actually happened. But since then, I mean, I started my high school's Amnesty International chapter. I had always been interested in human rights. Injustice in general, which is why I went to law school later on, finding out that that probably isn't the best place to go if you're interested in justice and justice alone, because the legal system moves very slowly and I'm very impatient. So for me, it was much too slow for me to continue being a lawyer.
So now you get a diagnosis. When were you diagnosed with bipolar disorder?
I was 29 years old. It was 2008. I had been, like a lot of people, I'd been diagnosed. The average time that people are misdiagnosed, the average time that people are misdiagnosed is 8 to 10 years. For me, it had been 10 years. I was misdiagnosed with unipolar depression. It's common for men to be misdiagnosed with schizophrenia and women to be misdiagnosed with depression for some reason. But because of that, I was given the wrong medications. When I was on medications, which wasn't all that often, so my illness was untreated. So it got to the point where I had an acute manic episode and the complete psychotic break, at which point it's very easy to diagnose bipolar disorder. And it's the most extreme form because I have hallucinations and delusions and things like that.
Well, or misdiagnose it as schizophrenia. I mean, that's pretty much symptomatic of that as well, that break.
Yeah. I think with mania, definitely a lot of people will be misdiagnosed with schizophrenia. And I think that happens in minority communities a lot more. Unfortunately, because schizophrenia, the medications to treat that are very different than the medications to treat bipolar, although pharmaceutical companies have been trying to push antipsychotics on everyone who possibly could take
everyone
them.
Everyone who can afford them. So tell me this, though. Why do you think it's more prevalent, misdiagnosis is more prevalent in minority communities?
You know, in general, for one, minority communities are not as willing to get help. There's an issue of access and socioeconomic levels. You need to pay for help, and it's expensive. And we do have mental health parity, but it does not really exist. The regulations to actually enforce mental health parity aren't there, and we aren't enforcing it. So insurance companies aren't covering mental health in the same way. And I know Patrick Kennedy is working a lot to make that happen, and I really admire him for doing that.
And then there's the question of whether or not mental illness is the one thing you can't talk about. Certainly in your case, that does happen. I think it happens everywhere, but it can be an extra layer of difficulty for minority populations who already have things they shouldn't be talking about or find difficult to talk about openly in the population. In your case, what happened when you got the diagnosis, and what did people closest to you tell you about what to do?
I'm lucky in the sense that both my parents are physicians, my sister is a physician, my best friend is a psychiatrist. So immediately, everyone close to my husband is the smartest person I know. So everyone close to me immediately accepted that this was a real illness that needed treatment. So I was never told that I needed an exorcism or things like that, which a lot of people with bipolar, unfortunately, are told, you know, pray harder, especially for me being a religious person in general. Or at least devout or devoted. No one ever said that to me, and that was great. But my family was, you know, the Iranian community is very gossipy. Something can happen in LA, and by the time it gets to Tehran, you know, I could just have been admitted to the hospital. By the time it would get to Tehran, I would be in the back ward, having been there for a year, eating Jell-O and doing puzzles and catatonic. So, yeah, it's a gossipy community. So my parents very much wanted to protect me from that. But I'm not, like you said, I'm not a quiet person. And I think that shame is something that promotes silence, and that silence keeps us from getting the funding we need, from getting the help we need. My goal one day is to get a National Alliance on Mental Illness walk that has just as many people as the breast cancer walks. But you go. Nobody wants to go to that. Immediately you're admitting you have a mental illness, or there's someone in your family who does, so you have a genetic predisposition, if anything. So my hope is that we can, you know, 25% of Americans have a mental illness in a given year. That's a lot of people. If we were to actually stand up and do something, we could get a lot more funding. We could get a lot more care. And that's a lot of the reason that I wrote the book was...
Well, a couple of things very important about what you just said. Number one, that the personal is political, that the ability to speak out has to be important to the individual who has been diagnosed, but also it has very important political implications. That's number one. But also this business of why it's easier to do a march for breast cancer than it is for mental illness. There is an underlying suggestion that when you're the victim of a biological illness like breast cancer, it happened to you. And there's this feeling, this ambiguous feeling that if you're mentally ill, somehow you're responsible for it.
Definitely. And I think it's seen as a character flaw, a moral failing by a lot of people. And I calling it not biological to me is an issue because it is a brain disorder. And there have been studies, if you look at the brain of someone with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, it's different. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go manic, and I don't want to have hallucinations. I don't want to be depressed for months at a time. People don't choose this. And in that sense, I think we can learn a lot from the LGBT community, because in terms of people telling us it's a moral failure, it's something that we can get over, Whereas it's, you know, it's part of who we are, and particularly the LGBT community in response to the AIDS crisis and how they stood up and acted up, right, and got drugs. You know, today you can, it's a chronic illness and you can live with it. But if it weren't for ACT UP, if it weren't for those AIDS activist groups, which were largely gay men, they wouldn't have the medications that they have today. And I feel like that's a really good model for us to use as people with mental illness.
Gay men who were active and had a voice and had some kind of privilege, at least in the initial phase when we first found out about AIDS in the 80s. And now that it has become an illness of people of color and finding itself in other communities, the valence has changed and the activism has changed. And the same kind of silence surrounding AIDS is now becoming a problem in those communities for the very reasons I think that you
right.
witnessed and
experienced. And, you know, they have privacy laws, very strong federal laws for privacy, protecting people who have HIV/AIDS. That's not the case with mental illness. I, for example, I'm a lawyer. I applied to take the bar. If you apply to take the bar today in many states, and it's something that's enforced by the National Conference of Bar Examiners as well as the American Bar Association, you have to answer a question that says, do you have bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, major depression in some states? And you have to answer that question under penalty of perjury. And some people have been denied licenses on that basis. And, you know, I understand that it's possible that we can commit acts that other people might not. But quite honestly, people with mental illness are no more violent than our so-called normal counterparts. We are actually four times more likely to be victims of violence. So to ask a question like that on licensure is a direct violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, for example. But the ABA feels fine doing it.
Well, and it suggests how little we know about bipolar. I mean, you talk about it just in the public perception, that's one thing. But you were misdiagnosed, and you say the average is 8 to 10 years or something like that.
Right.
That the professionals don't know what you have. So
exactly.
It seems like we don't know too, still don't know too much about this.
I think one of the problems, I won't put it all on the mental health professionals, although they have a burden to bear. They have some blame there. But we don't seek help with bipolar in particular. We don't seek help when we're manic because we're not only well, we're better than well, right? Who wants to come down from that? But eventually, something like mania turns ugly. So hypomania, which is the lower level of mania, a lot of people are able to function very well. There's been a book written about how a lot of presidents are hypomanic or mildly manic to be able to do all that they do. And one of the hard things about being misdiagnosed is at the time I was in law school, or I just finished law school. I had just finished writing my first book. I had finished a master's in public health, which, you know, anybody could do. But that should be a signal, I think, to mental health professionals that maybe if she only comes to me when she's depressed and is unable to do anything during those times, how is she able to function on such a high level? And people don't think of people with mental illness is being able to function on high levels. And that's so not the truth.
Well, and to extend that, how much of your success, I mean, I think you pointed to it, talking about the number of presidents perhaps and others, how much of your success depends on the fact that this is something that we call a disorder, but in fact contributed to your success?
Indeed. Yeah. I'm a big fan of neurodiversity. I think that everybody has something to offer. And these disorders, of course, they can be painful in a lot of ways, both for ourselves and for our families. But there are benefits and advantages to having them. And to throw that away, I think, is a disservice to people with mental illness. To highlight it alone and, you know, the brilliant, crazy person, that kind of stuff, isn't something that I want to do. But at the same time, it's true that a lot of my accomplishments have been possible because of a certain personality that I have that is somewhat hypomanic a lot of the time.
Well, and it does suggest that the way we come at this and maybe the way the research is done to focus on the pathology and the disorder is not to see the complete human. So, yes, there are destructive tendencies and the inability to get anything done, self-destructive and others. We want to get at that. But maybe you won't get at that if you don't fully understand how the human works as a well human being and only look at pathology.
So true. And something with bipolar in particular and other mental illnesses is we're much more likely to have physical illnesses, so-called physical illnesses as well. But those aren't treated. in a lot of cases, and a lot of psychiatrists, unfortunately, and psychologists as well, almost encourage smoking. This is an epidemic among people with mental illness. More of them die of lung cancer than suicide. So, and suicide is a bit up to 25% of people with bipolar attempt suicide. So it's a big problem that they're not addressing because they just want to address our treatment. And in a lot of cases, treating someone, if they're catatonic, from being manic to being almost catatonic is proper treatment. And it's not. It really isn't. We deserve better. But if we don't stand up and come out, like I say, like the LGBT community, if we don't come out, then we're not going to get what we need.
Is there or are there signs that there is more openness and things are changing just in terms of the ability and willingness to speak out?
I think so. I think so to a certain extent. I think a lot of it has to do, you know, it goes both ways. You know, the media, Silver Linings Playbook, that kind of stuff, I think had some sort of effect. But then there's the media that when Newtown happened, immediately the response is, oh, this must be some crazy person. Of course, if that person were named Mohammed, not only would that person not be crazy, but a terrorist, right? Either both or one or the other. So those are other issues, of course. But yeah, the fact that we report on the media reports on mental illness only when there's some sort of tragedy that happens and not the majority of the 60 million people in this country who have a mental illness and are not violent.
And in terms of organizing for you to get people to speak out, it must be different. I mean, let's talk just about the Muslim American community. Now, you said that the people around you were a bit more enlightened, though they did encourage silence. Is there something about Muslim culture in particular? And then I'm going to extend that and say, it seems to me that there might be particular problems within various communities that are all different, but adding up to a kind of verdict of silence when it comes to mental illness.
For sure. For sure. And denial in a lot of cases, which obviously you're going to be silent if you're denying something. But I think in the Muslim community, it happens a lot in the faith community in general, that we're told we can pray this away. But one thing about Islam in particular is the history of the Islamic Renaissance and a lot of focus on science and math. And if we can approach it from that angle, I think, and you know, I mean, the greatest thing it's very much like any Jewish mother, any Muslim mother wants her child to be a doctor, right? So this is something, medicine is really well respected. So if we approach it from the angle of knowledge and facts, I think we can get a lot farther.
You know, and it's ironic, too, that it is true that in religious culture there's a sense of blame and a sense that somehow this is the wages of sin. On the other hand, the word mad itself means touched by God. So, and that's how it's evolved through the ages. What do you hope to accomplish with your book?
Hopefully to get more people to share their stories and come out so that we can change the system that we have.
Melody, pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Melody Moisey is a writer and an attorney, and her memoir is called Haldol and Hyacinth, A Bipolar Life. She's going to be at Quail Ridge Books at 7:30 on August 7th, going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on August 12th, McIntyre's Fine Books in Pittsburgh on the 17th. And for more information, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. There's more of the State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned.